We smoothly transition.
Yeah, we can no longer talk about my poop schedule, actually. It's inappropriate for the podcast. But wait, on your dog adoption thing, they asked me what my relationship was to you, and I said friend and business partner.
I mean, it's not wrong. If Adopt for Justice Rescue listens to this podcast, please know this is my formal audition to adopt your dog.
I literally just told my sister I want her to adopt a child so I could be that reference too. I like vouching for people I know. Like, I think that's fun.
Yeah, it's like there's a certain love I think you have to have when you do the reference. And I think that's why it feels heartbreaking when you ask professors for a recommendation and they say no, because it's like they said, we don't love you enough.
Yeah, no, it's fact. But it's also nice, like, having somebody ask, because, like, I feel like a lot of the time when you're giving somebody a reference, it's to their face, like, they're asking for an opinion and then you're giving it to them. Mm. But it's a fun little thing when the person's not around and, like, someone's asking you all these things about them and you're supposed to be their friend. Like, imagine I turned out to be the villain. Imagine I just fucking said, like, she can't handle a dog. She can't do anything, actually. She's emotionally
I feel like
unstable.
That's the Hannibal Lecter thing to do, but if I was Will Graham, you would confess that you lied and you would apologize.
No, it is true. I mean, if you were... This morning could not stop thinking about Hugh Dancy. Like, it was just truly, it took over my life. Daddy. And so I looked up his relationship with Claire Danes, and I was stressed because they've been married a long time. And I said, I don't want you guys to end ever, but I desperately want to be in a throuple. Like, I want in.
I mean,
I would also take being their baby. Like, if they wanted to
adopt a Bengali Indian girl.
If they ever, you know, Hugh, Claire, if you're listening, adopt me. Swing me in between your arms tenderly as your child.
Role play Stardust for me.
Do all of Stardust, but just you two.
Trisha is offering to play Rob De Niro's role, the cross-dressing pirate. He was honestly probably my top three characters of that film, you know?
I also just say the range on that man. Chef's kiss at Robert De Niro, just king, love, just so sexy, so hot, so...
He said gay rights before Hollywood did, let's be real.
No, he really did, and then in front of Hollywood, he said, fuck Trump, and I said, oh my God, what?
He did it with his Italian hands, too.
He did!
And fuck Trump.
Oh, don't do that. Robert De Niro's gonna haunt you.
I guess that was enough, like, fun banter intro for the pod.
I hope she uses none of that. Lara, use none of that and actually don't give us an intro this time. Just start with really serious discussion.
Lara is the chaotic control freak on this podcast, but I love her so much.
We all love her. We stan. I feel like podcast listeners, I know not a lot of you are male, but for the men listening, if you're single and you're attracted, reach out to Laura, Felice. Just do it.
But also, if you're a woman and you're interested.
Oh, right.
Because Trisha is the sole straight person on this podcast.
I'm tragically hetero and I'm limited in my views and I'm sorry. Yeah, if you're a woman, reach out.
But speaking of women, this week we're talking about something. I was criticized for my clunky segues yesterday.
Clunky segues
was what it was called, and I feel like this is this is exactly what I'm doing, a clunky segue, but I don't care because I am talking about something that I really love.
Yes,
it's super toxic. It's called archetypes.
They're called stereotypes and cliches.
But I think I don't know what it was this year, but somehow Trisha and I ended up talking about what it meant to be a cool girl. And then from there, it went on to like tagging ourselves in all these tropes. And I have to preface that I personally tag myself in everything because I have such a low sense of self. I'm clinging on to tropes. And I think the problem with that is that when you're a girl and you have this example of what to be, you fall into it. And then when you realize it's like harmful, it's really hard to step out of that role and just figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, I often also don't think that there is a place to step out of it into. We're just not there yet. That's why feminism is a fucking thing, is because we're not in a space where women can just step out of tropes and like into just a free space. I feel like you have to step out of a trope into another trope. You have to like build a new trope and then you get to leave. But that, you know, and I think we'll get to that when we talk about Phoebe Waller-Bridge's, because I think that's a fascinating thing. It's where like you get to step out of the cliche into another cliche, but you don't get to, there's no free space. It's not like bingo, you know, you don't walk into a free space.
So I think we have to ground this conversation in, I feel like we have to start with Olivia Gatwood.
Oh, so you want to inform the public? I think that's really fucked up, Ambar. I actually think we should just talk willy-nilly without any research or information.
We won't base anything in anything but in fake news.
I love to hear it. I actually do love unobjective, subjective media.
Olivia Gatwood is a contemporary feminist poet. She has been performing for about 10 years now. I'm pretty sure if you're a Tumblr girl, you've seen Ode to My Resting Bitch Face or Alternate Universe. I forget the full name of that poem, but you've seen it and you've probably seen artwork accompanying it. And the reason for it is because she has this really great lens into analyzing what it means to be a girl in a male-dominated world and wanting to be a girl the way men see her, but also in a way that she can reclaim power. And so in her poetry book that came out last year, Life of the Party, it's about the intersections of true crime and how culture romanticizes violence against women. And I forget the exact poem, but there's a line in one of them that goes, I'm a good girl, bad girl, sad girl, dream girl, girl next door sunbathing in the driveway. I want to be all of them at once. I want to be all the girls I've ever loved. And I think in that sentence is probably the thesis of this entire episode, which is to say that we want to support women and we all recognize how we all fall into these different tropes. And it's only in recognizing that these tropes have been criticized that we can try to find ways to productively subvert them. And for now, even if that's not going to happen, at least we recognize it. And I think acknowledgement is what she's really striving for.
Yeah. I mean, I think of these tropes, in more recent years, I've started to think of these tropes, especially like meeting people like you in college and stuff. I've started to realize that these tropes are definitely the way women also view themselves and other women. But for a long time, I also saw it as the real-time male gaze. Now, a lot of people refer to the male gaze as something that's entirely cinematic, and they'll be like, oh, it's done from the male gaze, or this is, or even a book thing, right? It's like,
yeah,
this is written from a male's perspective, like this is clearly how men view women. But the truth is these tropes not only come out of the male gaze in real time, they come out of like the woman's gaze. But I don't know if we even have one yet, right? Because I think a lot of the time what's marketed as the woman's gaze is like Magic Mike, like women want to see this.
Yeah.
Or it's like rom-coms, right? It's like, that's the woman's gaze. But if we're looking at these tropes and we're thinking about the way in which we inevitably sort of ascribe ourselves to them, or like the way we label each other into these markers, you know, like one, I hate to bring up this example because it's like the most obvious one, but it's true. It's like this little woman-made movie about girls in high school, like Mean Girls, right? Or even Clueless. It's like women-made movies. Actually, I don't even know if Clueless was made by a woman, but it's sort of supposed to be the woman's gaze is like that sort of fitting into some sort of clique.
Mm.
And I think, yeah, what you said is necessary. It's like acknowledgement is necessary to realize that these tropes are stemming from something else and there's a sort of critique behind the whole thing. But also part of it is recognizing when you're on, like just subconsciously becoming a part of them, like when you're starting to, you know, it's like what you said earlier, it's like you admittedly like tag yourself to them and then you have to think about why do you do that and why in certain situations you tag yourself in different ones but you never really find a space without any of them. Like I could not say, at least for me, that I've ever been in a space that hasn't been ascribed a role already, whether it was Mean Girl or Sad Girl or Manic Pixie Dream. Like, I don't think I've ever not been one of those at any given time.
I wanna, I really liked what you said about the female gaze and it not existing, because it doesn't. It's a farce. It's reclaiming the power of objectification, which is still a male-dominated thing. And I think we see it when we congratulate certain women in media for being powerful women, like Hillary Clinton. You know, she's constantly... Whatever her politics are, what I want to bring her up for the reason is that she was criticized for wearing pantsuits and stuff. And so people would make fun of her saying she's just a woman pretending to be a man. And you can argue whatever you want, but when I see her, I'm thinking of the ways we seize these male traits to be respected and to think that we're using them to step out of the space when really we're just becoming another version of cool girl.
Yes. No, it's so true. I actually think every iteration, right? We said manic pixie dream girl, mean girl, cool girl, and sad girl. I think every iteration of these tropes has to do with a woman sort of subsuming a masculine space. So it's not like they actually are free women who are strong on their own. They become strong, or they become these things by way of adopting masculine traits. So I'm like, oh, so for a woman to be cool, she has to do typically male things. Or for a woman to be, you know, sad, she has to sort of have like a repressive emotional ability that comes out in weird ways. So she has to be emotionally stunted, like a lot of men have felt. And I think the very interesting thing about that is, like what you said earlier, it's the female gaze interpreted by the male gaze. So the female gaze is not real, because it's just reimagined by the same sort of toxic masculinity that it produced from.
That reminds me of the article that we were talking about a couple of days ago. Let me find it. It was a BuzzFeed article, and it's called "The Smartest Women I Know Are All Dissociating." And I think this is the next step, the in-between of the trope acknowledgement and then a way to subvert it. And so you'll see it in Fleabag, but it's the idea that you're dissociating and you have this out of body experience because you're trying to find a space that hasn't been colonized, essentially. And instead of claiming it, you come back into your body when it's done. And so I think the easiest way to explain this is that meme. I don't know if you've seen it. It's like, it's in different iterations. I think it's funny, but it's Jackie and Kelso from That 70s Show, and Kelso is like nibbling at Jackie's neck, and the caption is something like, fuck, don't all girls feel this when the guy is just kissing and you just can't wait for it to be over, or something like that. And it's supposed to be funny because it's like, oh yeah, guys don't know about female pleasure, but I think it's more so watching ourselves outside of ourselves because there's something discomforting in the moment. It's seeing yourself the way a man sees you and wanting to work your way around that and then trying to step out of that only to come back and the cycle starts over again.
Yeah. Yeah. This is making me sort of think of, and I don't know if this ever has happened to you, but I remember I told you once, and I'm just going to expose myself on this podcast, but I said that I sometimes often feel power, especially as a person who generally feels very insecure. Mm. I sometimes very much feel power from acting in a certain way, in a very objectified way, because I like sometimes having the male gaze. And like, again, I don't think there's anything wrong with that necessarily, but the problem with that is it increases your sort of dissociation in that moment, because you're both, it's sort of for you and not for you, because you're playing up the sort of validation, the pseudo validation you receive by playing to the male gaze. But meanwhile, while you're doing that, you're recognizing the discomfort you feel in having to do that to get power. Because it's not the same for females, right? Like, because I'm heterosexual, if I dressed up, wore a low cut top, and like put on a bunch of makeup for you, I'd feel good, but I wouldn't feel like powerful in the same way as if I did that on purpose, went to the club and tons of guys looked at me. I would feel some sort of validation that is clearly a production of like the way society perceives women. Like, I've just internalized it and allowed that to become my grab for power. But I think in that there's a lot of dissociation, which you have to recognize that you're both powerful and powerless in the same situation.
And eventually, essentially, it just cancels out, right?
Yeah, and then you matter feel in like the nothingness. End. Yeah. That's the sad part. It's the end of the night nothingness with your heels in your hand, and you're just walking along the sidewalk. And you just
a walk of shame.
Yeah, it's the end of the night nihilism that gets you.
I don't know. I was talking to someone I dated a couple of months ago, and he called me out on the performativity I was doing, but he didn't realize that it was tied to performing for a male gaze. He just thought it was just like, oh, trying to impress me. And essentially it is. I don't know what it is about. There's like a sick pleasure, I think, in doing it. It's results based. And so I think as someone who seeks validation through like accomplishment and achievement, I think there's something very academic almost about the way that we pursue male validation, you know?
It is sort of quantitative, arguably. Like, it's not about the quality of the male gaze that you're receiving. It's just about how much of it you can receive, which I also found was kind of the reason I deleted the dating apps, too. It's like I would spend so much time just wondering why I wasn't getting more likes. But it was also just like, yeah, you're not going to be everything to everyone, but you so desperately want to be something to someone.
Yes.
And as a woman, that's a very potent feeling, because you're sometimes you're stuck in a position where you're just nothing to everyone, and it's a very scary moment where you're like, I'm just being invalidated left and right, and the only way I can find my way to the table is by playing into the very system. Yeah, that subverts me. It's like, I don't know if, and you can obviously correct me if I'm wrong, but you can sort of, I argue that there's no way to subvert the system yet. We just have to keep playing within it to thwart it, which is sort of an unfair advantage on the male side. And that's why maybe things won't change. It's like, if you can't fight it by challenging it, and you continuously have to fight it from within, sometimes that message gets lost because the system is just structured that way.
Yeah, I think most obviously, or like visually at least, we see this in the body positive movement on Instagram. We see it in women trying to reclaim their bodies for themselves. And that's a really difficult thing to do, especially if you're a survivor of an eating disorder or sexual trauma. And so we see these pictures of women, at least I do, because I follow a lot of body positive accounts of women in their underwear. And it's not in a sexual context, but somehow it garners that response. And so you're criticized for it when you're trying to reclaim it. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, maybe this is all we can do at this moment, but it feels really sad that we have to do something that would be twisted and just tell ourselves that it's just for us. And this is not to be taken as like slut shaming or anything. I want to realize that when I am dressing for myself, I want to make sure that I'm doing it because I would feel good in it. And I think that's a really hard line to straddle when you're single, at least, or maybe if you're with someone, but I don't know.
Yeah. I also think that there's oh my God, I really keep saying yeah after everything you say, like a fucking frat bro. yeah, bro. But I agree with that there's an unfortunate sort of consequence to women trying to rally for their rights. And it's that their sense of empowerment is sort of belittled. But it's not belittled by direct male response necessarily. It's sort of, I think, belittled by an internalized sense of that male response.
Yeah.
And I kind of want to bring it back to the tropes, because I do want to flesh out this idea. And I'm going to use body positivity as the example because I think it's a great one. It's like, if you think about these tropes, right? If you say, cool girl, her response to body positivity would be like, yeah, I'm fucking fat and I don't care. And she would use fat proudly, and it would be that whole thing. And there's no room for this type of girl to ever have a sort of body dysmorphia, or for her to look in the mirror and be like, oh, but I feel fat today, or I feel not cute about the way my arm looks, you know, this shirt, which is the case. It's like, you can be comfortable being your weight and still have days where you feel the societal hallmark of that weight. Like the societal.
You called out that Amy Schumer movie without saying that it was, I feel pretty.
Yeah, no, I really did. But it's funny because these tropes all sort of already, it's like a pre-response to what they think women will feel, which is scary, because then women don't get to have an actual response. And essentially it's sort of a version of silencing where you give them a voice that isn't entirely theirs, right? And so like if I move on to the next trope, let's say mean girl, right? A mean girl's response to getting fat would literally be to belittle herself and everyone around her and like work on getting skinny and like doing the whole thing and being like, it's not because of society though. It's just because like, I want to be whatever. And I don't stand for the way this looks and you know, whatever. And it's like the mean girl just has to be aggressive about her approach to the one thing. But it's like mean girl can also have sad girl day where she sits and she's like, my body is not the way I want it to look. And that is in response to both media perception of women's bodies, but also in response to just the way I feel about my body. Like maybe I just don't like looking the way I look. But then, you know, sad girl can't have that response. God forbid. Her response fully has to be, I'm sad about my body. You know?
There's and it's a certain like, romanticism that you need with all of these tropes, especially. It's living a daydream. And as all daydreams do, they just pop. And so if we're continuing to talk in the body positive way, none of these tropes allow for ownership. None of them.
There's no agency in ascribing to a trope. And for a long time, I felt very proud of them. You know, like if you're ascribed to a trope that you feel is good, you feel proud of being that type of girl, right? Especially if we're talking about in today's world when people say like, I'm not like other girls, but they say it unironically. Yeah, it's sort of that phenomenon where you're like, I'm not the mean girl. I'm not the sad girl. I'm the cool girl. I'm that girl, you know, or I'm the manic pixie dream girl. Like I'm quirky and fun and men love me. But there's nothing great or feminist about not being like other women, because what you're essentially saying is not only am I not like other women, I'm willfully trying to be like other men.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just jumping from category to category. I think when I hear that, when I'm not like other girls, I am reminded of being young and instantly understanding, like, I don't know if you've had moments like this, like a double consciousness of being reminded that you're performing, of being a kid and in a daycare and knowing that while your girlfriends were fine, there was something really powerful about being able to ride with the boys and being as fast as the boys. Because I think there's this false idea, at least I think what I had was that equality meant being accepted into it, which implies that men, again, still have the ability to invite you to their table as opposed to just sitting there on your own.
You're talking about the tomboy label, and it has irked me for most of my life.
Yeah. Can you elaborate on your own tomboy hood? Tomboy.
Yeah. So, Ambar, as long as you've known me, and for people who are listening who don't know me that well, I have often been marked as a lesbian, which I don't really mind, like, whatever. That's a weird label to ascribe to me, but okay. But it's like people who don't even know me will just say, like, oh, I assumed you were lesbian, or I just thought you were lesbian. I will always, every single time, I will always ask why. Like, what about, not in a defensive way, more in a, I want to know what in your mind sort of you processed and thought lesbian must be. And it's always arbitrary physical things, but it's also related to the way men view women. And it goes all the way back to this tomboy trait. It's like, if you spend your time trying to fit into masculine roles, all of a sudden you can no longer be feminine in any way. Like, you can't, especially in a heterosexual way, men cannot possibly, you could not like men if you are like men. But when I hear people say that, they'll be like, oh, it's just the way you dress, because you don't really wear like tight clothes or revealing clothes, or you don't really go to parties, and like, I've never seen you even talk to a guy. I'm like, oh, so all those things mean I'm butch? Like, how did that two and two, how did that come together? And where do those labels come from? Because that's another role that you're being ascribed. And I'm like, where's the free space? Why can't I just fit into this like non-normative space and just chill?
Yeah, gender fluidity, man. I don't know. I can admit to that as well, as even women meeting other women and assuming that. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, she must be a lesbian. And then we were talking about Rihanna, and then you went, yeah, I mean, I'm not into girls, but like, Rihanna's hot. And I was like, what the fuck? She's not.
I said, no homo. I love Rihanna. I pulled a no homo.
I don't know. I also think, if we're going to talk, because I feel like right now what we're talking about is this, essentially what this whole conversation is about is just queerness. And I think if we're talking about women performing for other women, I think that's something that also needs to be discussed. You know, it's like, no matter what, there is always going to be an audience. And I think in female friendships, what's so special about them is that you're both aware of that you're performing at the same time, and you're actively trying to combat it. But I mean, I don't know, I hate this conversation because I feel so embarrassed about talking about it, because I feel like I'm exposing myself. But I think there's something really good about seeking validation from other women. And I think I rather get it from another woman than a man, because at least there is no imbalance in power.
Yeah, I agree with that. But the interesting thing is, while you were talking, like, I love that you said, right, women performing for other women, that's like a conversation we need to have. I absolutely agree with that, because while it's so important to seek validation from other women, that's probably the most valid form of validation, women are also very, very hesitant to give it out to other women. And that is almost a worse space to be in. Because you meet men who very, very often are just willing to just give out validation, even if you didn't ask for it. Men sometimes feel very
paternal.
Yeah, they feel very free to just give out validation, yeah, left and right to women in a sort of condescending way most of the time. And it's like, I think you're hot, I think you're sexy, I think you're smart, don't say that stuff about yourself. And it's like, okay, thank you, you fixed all my problems, cute.
Don't die, you're too sexy.
That is what they say. But women, I think, don't get it enough from each other, and have sort of felt, it's sort of this embarrassment. You feel this embarrassment in like thinking the things you do about each other and feeling the way you do about each other in a good way. So you just repress it and never give it out. Like, I think women also are portrayed as catty a lot towards other, yes, women.
Yes.
And the truth is, there is a little bit of reality to that, but it stems from something much greater. It's not that they're necessarily catty because they're actually mean people and want to be mean to other women, but it's that embarrassment of, it's not even embarrassment, it's sort of that you don't want to lose your power being not like the other girls. So you sort of tear them down, because what else do you have? It's like, I don't want to be grouped in with these other powerful and strong women, because then I become one of many.
Yeah.
But if I stand alone as powerful and strong and the rest of you look weak, it's unfortunate, but it's me working within the system. I'm sorry. I have something. I have a goal. I have somewhere I need to go.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's an unfortunate byproduct, you know?
I think what's also interesting about that is that when we, because all of these are learned behaviors. And so if we're going to talk about learned behaviors, we see this in the media and like the books we consume. And so for me, whenever I've seen male created works that involve women bonding together, it's always portrayed in like a funny manner. Like it's hilarious at the idea of women becoming friends, you know?
Yeah.
So I think, especially now that we're having more female created content, there's like a positivity that's being changed in the way that we see women grouping together. And I wish we had had that when we were younger, if I'm going to be frank.
Yeah. But I also do feel like for the longest time, there was never a real sense of women grouping together without a male presence. Even if that was a homosexual male presence, it just had to be there in order for the women's friendship to seem legitimate. There's always this sense of sort of you can't leave women alone with each other because if you do, they'll turn on each other, which is a lot of like women friendship movies are based on this idea of women like being very close and tight and they share everything. And then some stupid thing like inevitably gets them to like hate each other for most of the movie. And by the end, they like get over it. And then they're like, no, we're best friends. Kiss, kiss, hug, hug. And there's just no sense of nuance in both their friendship, but also in the way women's emotions are highly tied to media, patriarchy, sexuality. It's just, there is no complexity in the perception of women's relationships with one another, but also as just women themselves, if that makes sense.
It makes an uncomfortable amount of sense. I'm thinking of the rise of like those female-led comedies that came out in the mid-2000s. And you're right. They're all connected to the idea of losing each other to men. I think of Bridesmaids especially, because even though it's majority women for the entire time, it's all about how Helen, for example, who's considered the villain, she has become the ideal woman because she is accepted by male desire. And it's only at the end when she confesses how much of a farce that is that the other women feel comfortable enough to acknowledge it's not a competition. But maybe there's some truth to that. Maybe women need to reconcile that nothing is a competition in a female friendship to become friends.
Yeah. I mean, I think the power structures in female friendships are far greater than male friendships. And if you remember, there was like a weird period of time, and by weird period of time, I mean like a whole decade of our lives in which there was this whole thing about male friends are so much better than having female friends. That's why I only hang out with dudes. And there was this sort of idea, it's because dudes don't have quote unquote drama, but it's because they negotiate power differently because they already have it. And so dudes in a group don't feel a sense of distance already from each other because they all know that whatever situation they're in, they'll be viewed entirely the same and at the same level as equals. But women can never guarantee that, because if I go out in public with someone who's clearly better looking than me, I can't guarantee that people will look at us the same. And if we go to a bar and someone starts chatting you up and I'm sitting there alone, there's a sort of discomfort because you want to be there as a friend and love that moment. But you also recognize that there's this like festering ugliness between you where you're like,
yeah,
I'm just alone now. And this person has like abandoned me, which is like a horribly exaggerated feeling, but it stems from like getting attention versus not. And I think that's what a lot of people assume women want, is simple attention. But what we actually want is to be heard. And there's like a difference between getting attention and being heard, you know?
I think in that sense of wanting attention versus being heard, I think that's something we can easily apply to the subversion of each of these tropes. I think in Cool Girl, if we're going to talk about the ultimate cool girl, we have to talk about Amy Dunn, for example, of Gone Girl, and that insane monologue that she has. But she, the way she gets to be heard is in a sociopolitical thriller in which she frames her husband for murder and for sexual assault. And while that's an incredibly nuanced psychological portrait, I think it shows that there are ways in which we can do that, and that this is a girl who has felt the cool girl dilemma and found a way to be heard. Now she had to be heard in a chase in which she was supposed to be murdered, but it was a method.
Yeah. I mean, to piggyback off of that, I actually also really want to talk about Penny Lane from Almost Famous. Just because I think it's sort of the same idea of threading the line between a woman who's constantly just used for attention and then all of a sudden does something to topple that.
Yeah.
And still holds attention, but also demands to be heard, even though it's through the most psychotic way possible. It's still progress in a way.
Yeah.
If you've never seen Almost Famous, spoilers, Penny Lane is basically a groupie for this band. She follows them everywhere, and the band sort of uses her as like a bartering chip for the most of the movie. So they use her as both the groupie, but also there are moments where they kind of gamble her off, and they're like, you could take Penny Lane, you could take the groupies if you want them, you know? And she's very much a manic pixie dream girl, where she's like, music is life and I feel strongly about this band and I'm just here to make these men like feel powerful. But as the movie progresses, you realize Penny Lane also very much has mental health issues, and she sort of overdoses and they don't really hear from her. And this is at the point in which the band feels very dependent on Penny Lane for their power, she sort of disappears. And by the end of the movie, basically, this one guy tries to get in touch with her and get her number, and she gives him the number of another man who they need to make amends between. And in a way, Penny Lane sort of, her character goes from being solely for male power to, in a way, being recognized as a driving force for reconciliation. It's not perfect because in the end, she's still only helping the men get to their ultimate goal. But it does allow for a little bit more than just look at these women as this one static thing. I don't really know how to finish that sentence. It just kind of allows for more than singularity. Yeah.
I feel like we also have to preface that it's so easy to come up with examples of each of these tropes because we've seen it before. And I think there's one that's glaringly obvious to me, and that's Natasha Romanoff, Black Widow in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think that's a woman that gets far too much credit for being a powerful, dominant force in the Avengers. And she's considered an Avenger, but have you ever really seen Black Widow on their merchandise? And even in the films, it's really cool that Scarlett Johansson can do a drop kick or whatever. But have you noticed that all of her storylines involve helping the men around her and being a romantic love interest for them? I feel like there are
Not to even address, by the way, the just the aggressive sexual gaze that is put on her in the in the fucking outfit and the way she whispers all her lines. It's something.
You're telling me there's nothing sexy about a little Russian girl?
Girl?
Growl.
Oh, I thought you just mispronounced girl, and I was like, I'm Bart.
No. I think too often we see a stereotypical, strong, powerful woman in media and think, oh, that's a woman that's not a trope. She's herself. She's unique. And really, she's not. Just because this woman can, you know, kill a man, which is admirable, it doesn't mean that she's doing it for herself.
Yeah. I mean, it's entirely intended that people like Black Widow. It's so weird to me because that's sort of another trope that finds its way into the four tropes we're talking about, but this sort of maternal female. And I've realized that it happens a lot with female superheroes like Wonder Woman and Black Widow. It's this sort of self-effacement. So people think it's strong because it's sacrificial, which she is. Like, if you don't want spoilers for the Avengers, FYI, Black Widow is entirely sacrificial. She's supposed to be strong. But at the end of the day, she does not get to live. She does not get to reap the benefits of that strength because it's not hers.
And I also want to say, with her sacrifice, the only reason it makes sense for her is because she literally cannot have kids. And so yes. Not only is she not, she's fuckable, but she can't have kids. So is she really a woman then? Therefore, it's fine to toss her away because she can't fulfill the maternal trope, but she'll do it for the men anyway.
But she does it subliminally. So if she can't biologically fulfill the maternal trope,
yeah,
she has to do it some other way, and she has to die for it, essentially. And it happens in Wonder Woman too, where she doesn't die, but her entire purpose is to save the world on behalf of herself. And I think it's so funny because if you look at male superheroes, they feel that sense of responsibility, but it's always offset by a giant support system that like helps them out. Like Iron Man's got Jarvis, you know, like you know, Captain America has Falcon. Like everybody's got their buddy team sort of movie, or they have this whole system. The Avengers is just all, it's a circle jerk. It's just about men going out and helping each other save the world. And then you have these single women films in which the women feel the need to save the whole world, and they're actually quite expected to.
Yeah.
And it, God forbid they take the help of a man, then it's not as feminist. It like devalues the film. But it's like women also need help, men. You need to also help our voices be heard. We can't, it's sort of this idea that a woman is only strong if she can achieve her goals by herself. And it's very scary.
Oh my God, yes. Okay, so there's this episode of BoJack Horseman that I think is a really great, in which, spoilers if you're not caught up on the last season, Princess Carolyn is the ambition, I don't know if you know her, Trisha? She's the
pink cat. She's the cat? Yeah.
Yeah. She's a literal pussy.
They really did say that.
But she is priding herself on her ability to overwork herself. And then once she adopts Ruby, there's this episode where they capture every frame of her motion, and it's going on. Like there's like thousands of Princess Carolyn's like burping her baby or like typing up a news briefing all at the same time. And I think that's one of the best portrayals of what it means to be a woman, is to try to be maternal, to try to take care of everyone else, to succeed in a male dominated world, and to do it all without asking for help.
Yeah, it's, oh my God, if I say yeah one more time, Lau, I'm gonna lose it.
And the cool thing about it is that it's explained visually, it's conveyed in a way that can't be argued. You know, you don't have to argue with a man who insists that your experience is not real, because if he's watched BoJack Horseman, he can see that in Princess Carolyn.
There's actually a lot of testimony from first-time mothers. Don't ask me why I read testimonies from first-time mothers. I guess I also feel very maternal some days. But there's so much testimony from first-time mothers that often explain this very experience that I think women are aware of before they become mothers, but it's only when they're mothers they have to actually enact it in a very physical way. But there's so much testimony where it's like women start to realize, especially in America where our economy doesn't support pregnant women, they just don't support maternity in a good way.
What, so you mean they want women to be mothers, but they don't support mothers? That's crazy.
They basically said, either you're a housewife or you're nothing. We said, cool. But yeah, there's just a lot of testimony that says, you know, I had this kid, which is not only just a physical thing, people, it's a very emotional, mental, physical, it's like you have this thing in your body for 9 months, you know, give birth, but it's very much a connectivity, and it's psychological and it's physical and it's a lot of things. And all of a sudden you have this sort of break between work and home, but then also even between those two things you have a bigger break, because it's like you're not the same person that was in that relationship before. There's like a new facet to your whole life, which is motherhood, and the way you view your parents now is not only just as your parents but as somebody's grandparents. And all of a sudden all your friends, you know, your relationship to them is different, because maybe you're ahead of them or maybe you're behind them, and maybe all your conversations are about this kid, you know. And you have to have a sort of like seven eyes in which you're doing everything at once. And I think fatherhood especially is a highly underrated thing, or like just even having like a partner in all of that is often underrated, because the birth giver is supposed to be
self-sufficient.
Yes, self-sufficient.
Intuitively.
The assumption is that if women can biologically do this crazy, miraculous thing, like they call it the miracle of life, which I think sounds too majestical, and it gives men this utopian idea that women are somehow like magical beings that can overcome anything. They can endure a great amount of pain because they can do that. Is very crazy to me, because although biologically I can do that, again, there has to be some sort of support beyond that, because my whole life is changing. And while everybody else's, it's like, you're expecting me to not only give birth, but it's like you've given birth to two things, right? You gave birth to a very physical being, but then you gave birth to a whole new life, and everyone's saying, take care of both as a mother. And it's a very crazy thing.
We also see that in men and women, like heterosexual relationships, especially. When you have the relationship, it's treated as your baby, and also your partner is one as well. And so I think we also saw this with Ariana Grande and what's his name, Mac Miller?
Yeah,
when he died of an overdose, she was accused of not taking care of him, as if that was her responsibility. And I think we so often assume that caretaker, in whatever trope you are, it will always assimilate in there. And so in Ariana Grande's Cool Girl, Manic Pixie Dream Girl stuff, she's supposed to be the muse who inspired his album and therefore gave him a reason to live. And that is far too much pressure to put on any woman.
Yeah. Well, I think the tropes also, it's interesting because two of the tropes, even arguably three of the tropes, assume that women are supposed to be that caretaker. And the one trope, which is Mean Girl, is the woman sort of becomes a caretaker for herself, but in doing so, she becomes also aggressive and rude. And so there's also the assumption, it sort of subverts the claim of the strong woman in and of itself, because it's stating, if you choose to put yourself first, then you're mean. Yeah. Then that's just a mean thing to do. Which makes me sort of think to Mother's Day, actually. Because on Mother's Day, I always have funny feelings about that, because don't get me wrong, love my mom. But on Mother's Day, you'll get all these testimonies, and I especially like looking at like my guy friends on Instagram, they'll post these like long things being like, I would be nothing without my mother. This woman slaved away for us, like, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, but you're seeing her do these things, and I wonder how often in your life you've ever considered the impact you've been having, like, the consequence of you just recognizing that and not being able to help her.
Yeah.
It's like, there's got to be a moment where your mom stops being your mom and she's just a woman, and you have to sit there and take that. Like, I want to know, and this is also true for me, it's sometimes I take my mom for granted and I'm like, yeah, she's doing all these things and I expect her to do certain things for me just because she's my mom. But then I'm like, what if I just sat there and let her speak for a minute? Would I have to actually consider my mom as something more than just a mother and a fully actualized person? Probably.
That hurt.
it's true, right? Like, because on Mother's Day is like the biggest way of fitting moms into that trope. It's like, is your mom one of those house moms, or is she the strong woman? Like, she raised me alone, single mother, like she did everything by herself. But either way, those are both still tropes of motherhood. And it's unfair to look at moms as a sort of like one or the other, because they're also women. Like, it's just.
No, I hear that. What I'm reminded of is just, because essentially it's just when you said a woman can't say no to this self-sacrifice, it's like, why? We have, at least for me, I find that all of my friends are women like me, which is to say they will struggle on them by themselves. They won't ask for help. And then later on, they'll complain about it, knowing that the solution was to say no. And that's not to say I don't do it, because I do it constantly.
Yeah. Well, there's this interesting thing. There's this movie I watched, and it's an Indian movie, but basically in the movie, they're talking about marriage and they're talking about women's roles in society and, like, you know, why certain things are the way they are. And this mother is talking to her husband in the movie. This wife is talking to her husband. And she says, you know, I had to sacrifice all this stuff. Why can't my daughter? Why does she want to get a divorce? I sacrifice stuff. She can learn to compromise. And the husband gets really upset because he's like, what did you sacrifice? Like, I didn't force you to sacrifice anything. And so the mother basically goes into the story and she's like, of course you did. When I was younger, I wanted to be a singer. I had dreams. I wanted to genuinely wanted to be a singer. But I knew that once I got married, that just would, you know, be impossible. People would just look at me. I wouldn't have time for this family. Like, and you were always at work and I didn't want to leave the kids with like a nanny. Like, it just, it was too much. And he was like, well, I never stopped you. You could always do it. You know, this husband sort of, I don't know, he came at it from a, I would have never told you not to. And I didn't tell you not to. And she actually says, yeah, but you never asked why I stopped either when I stopped. You just assumed, because you knew deep down that it would mess up the family if I just kept singing. You never told me to stop, but you never asked why either. And I think that's honestly the most important thing I could ever think of. Is like when women are not saying anything, or when they're coming off as self-sacrificial, or when they're coming off as if they're fitting into these tropes, I think people take it very easily because they just make the assumption that the woman wants to be in these things or are acting out of consent.
Yeah.
With themselves, like they've consented to this. But I find it so interesting that no one ever asks why. No one has the audacity to take the initiative. Until the woman complains, there's not a single person, I could argue, who will ask her first if she is okay or why she's behaving a certain way. So it's up to the woman to vocalize that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, women speaking up for themselves. What a crazy idea.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But I mean, I think it's also up to other women too. Like, this is not just like adding men. This is adding everyone. Like, forget even gender labels. Like, I keep saying men and women, but I'm talking about all folk everywhere. It's sort of, you know, why does it have to be up to the woman to vocalize her pain before you realize that it's there? And I think a lot of people take that for granted because they see what's happening and they see it and they just assume that that's the woman's choice. And sometimes it is and sometimes it's not, but it doesn't hurt to ever ask and open that conversation. That allows a woman to not only feel comfortable, but to also feel like she has a free space and doesn't have to fall into preconceived notions of her womanhood.
Yeah. I also think there have been too many instances of when a woman either says no or she somehow receives permission to do what she wants, and then when it backfires, it's like an internalized response of like, oh, this is what happens when I let other people, when I don't let other people dictate what I do. Because there's a safety net of knowing, well, you told me to do this. You made me do this. So it's like, it's a way of also excusing the lack of agency that you have by blaming someone else and not taking accountability for it.
Okay, can you actually flesh that out a little? Like, what do you mean by not taking accountability for your lack of agency?
So, obviously this doesn't apply in every situation. What I'm thinking of is being a coworker, right? And you're working on a project. And someone finally gives you permission to lead. Say it backfires, say someone else takes credit for it. And you don't defend yourself. And I think part of the problem is that there, while there's also internal consequences of being disappointed in yourself and obviously wanting to do better, there's also a recognition that if you're gonna fight, it's going to backlash. There's like a risk of losing your job. There's a risk of maybe being coerced into doing something. You know, it just feels like, why bother if it's going to be hard? And that's not to, when I say hard, it's not to minimize the struggle. It's just bearing it down at its most simplest core.
Yes. You know what? I feel like you kind of added me, but in the best way possible. But I do want to talk about this because you are assertive. You've taken a lifetime to get there, but you're pretty assertive. And I'm very not. I'm very non-confrontational, and it's not necessarily because I'm peaceful. Like, it's not because I don't want to confront people necessarily. It's because I feel a sort of bubbling sense of fear every time I have to think about the consequences of confronting people, even if it's in my defense, even if I'm being misrepresented. I sometimes just allow that shit to happen because I'm not afraid the consequences necessarily will be physical or that they'll be detrimental. But even the minor thought that someone might actually have to now think of me as like a, it's because you get stuck in another trope and it's like, I don't want to be in another one. I don't want to be that girl.
Yeah. You want to be agreeable.
That attacks people. Yeah. And it's horrible when you realize that too. It's when you realize that you're going to be placed in another sort of limiting box. And you don't even like the one you're in necessarily, but the one, the alternative is so much worse.
Yeah.
And so again, women are sort of just left with these really, it's like the lesser of two evils, and women are constantly choosing those when really they shouldn't have to.
It's being revoked of the woman card, being revoked of the cool girl card. Like, how many times, I don't know if you have, but it's when you're complaining to your guy friends or something, and it's just like, I thought you were a cool girl, and they don't mean it in cool girl TM, but that's what it is. It's like, I thought you weren't going to call me out on that feminist stuff. You know, I thought you were cool. It's just like, fuck you.
Yeah, no, most definitely. It's the thing with guys too, is they don't realize when they're ascribing to a role. Mm. Like when they don't realize when they're putting you there. I mean, I'm sure some men do, but a lot of, I guess, 20-year-old boys definitely don't, from what I've experienced. And I remember this one time I was talking about this girl, and I wasn't being unnecessarily catty. I was just pointing out a point. Like, all the guys were like, yeah, she was cool. I mean, whatever. And they like went back to playing video games. And I was like, did you guys really think she was cool? Like, I thought she was a little, like, she was just too excitable, and she seemed like kind of a stoner, and that's just not my vibe. Like, I was like, really? You guys thought she was like cool? Because I found her really uninteresting and boring. And they were like, I feel like you're being kind of like mean. Like, calm down, bro. She was chill. And I was like, I'm not even being mean. I'm just saying, like, I didn't really vibe. Like, you guys didn't even talk to her that much. So, like, how are you going to say that she's cool?
And my guy friends, she's fuckable, therefore she's cool. That is the bare minimum.
Yeah, essentially, it wasn't even that she was fuckable. It's just that she was available in any sense of the word, so that if they wanted to talk to her, they could. If they wanted to waste her time, they could. And that's all they really needed to know. Whether she had a personality or not, it doesn't matter. Whereas I was like, oh, her personality kind of stinks. And all of them just sort of were like, oh, so you're like mean to other girls. And I was like,
turn the you're not like other girls on you.
Yeah.
You can't win.
I was like, okay, well, I guess I can't have an opinion about other people, period. Forget gender. Guess I can't think about anybody in a complex way.
Didn't you know you were just meant to be a body?
I'm finding out slowly but surely.
Yeah. I just feel really embarrassed right now.
Really? I do feel extremely exposed as a woman right now.
I just feel like I feel hypocritical when I talk about this stuff, but I also want to be incredibly transparent that I am quick to take blame. And I think that's also a little self-sacrificial, and so I keep coming back to the point of performativity. There is no point in which we aren't performing, and that's adding Michel Foucault on that matter, but it just feels like womanhood has become a prison, and when you try to abolish the prison, it's not going to work. There's no end in sight.
Yeah. 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 I don't know. I sometimes find a fear of ascribing to womanhood in and of itself, you know, but it stems from all these years of being called a tomboy or being called a, you know, cool girl TM. It's sort of like, I now find an aversion to women, to taking the label womanhood. But it's like, I am a woman, so what do I do now? Yeah, womanhood is a constant crossroads. Robert Frost did not think that one through, did he?
I have to bring up Robert Frost, though, in another context. There's a TikTok trend of using the audio recording of two paths diverged in a forest or something, whatever the fuck that poem is. And I've seen a lot of feminist content in it where it's girls who split it. One door, it's like wanting to be a hardcore radical feminist, and the other one, it's like wanting to be called a little slut in the bedroom. And so I feel like if that's any indication of the image we want to leave on this podcast, it is precisely that TikTok.
Yeah, it's basically, do you want to be a hardcore feminist or do you want to be a little slut in the bedroom? We're making our new tropes, bitches.
I don't know. I guess for our listeners, I would like to know, what are some moments you've recognized yourselves performing? What are some movies and TV shows you now have to reevaluate on who your favorite female character is, and if it's because they adhere to a trope that you yourself are doing? Thanks. Solid.
All right, guys, that's it. Thanks for listening. All right, guys, thanks for listening. Big shout out to Kieran Choi and his brother Connor Choi. Check them out. You can find them on YouTube. You can also find them on Facebook and Instagram. And also,
big thank you to our sound designer, Laura Feliz. She is a recent graduate of TCNJ's graphic design program. Check out her Instagram for more information.
Women of Dolor aims to alienate no one and address everyone in discussing topics of culture, society, and humanity in a way that bridges gaps of understanding and illuminates misinformation.